WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
It's Friday, which means it's time to catch up on what's been happening lately across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap. We're taking you behind the headlines with local journalists working on stories like these.
The rent went from $850 or $835 to $850 to now $1,300.
We need protections for our folks in the neighborhood. There cannot be luxury hotels in our neighborhood.
Whenever I got caught for curfew, all we did was wait till the cops left and then figured out how to get home or get where we was going.
A vigorous debate on a proposal to allow Chicago police to impose immediate curfews anywhere, anytime.
Outcry from civil rights groups, plus last-minute changes to this proposal shook some of the support.
This is about what we have to do as an entire state to ensure that all of Illinois is supported.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. To help make sense of the week's news, we sat down with Carrie Shepard, Chicago reporter with Axios, Sam Charles, criminal justice reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and Alex Degman, WBEZ State House reporter. Now, on Wednesday, Mayor Brandon Johnson made an appearance in Springfield to meet legislators at the state capitol.
I addressed the joint session, the first mayor to do that in a very long time. The Senate President Don Harmon is where I got my first job. You know, the Speaker Welch helped me become a county commissioner. These are Lakeisha Collins and I worked together as we pushed back against the shooting and the death of Laquan McDonald when we were organizers. Will Gazzardi, we helped people like him get elected. Rob Martwick. These are people who have been friends of mine. So I'm going to continue to show up and work on behalf of the people of Chicago. And the expectation is that these members of the General Assembly also show up on behalf of the people of Chicago. So that's a collective effort.
We kicked off our conversation by asking Alex how he would describe the mayor's relationship with legislators. Here's what he said.
Well, he did name a lot of legislators right there. And it's true that Chicago mayors typically do work with state lawmakers, but that's not particularly impressive or, you know, necessarily weird. He did come down to make his case for what Chicago needs, but this is the first time that lawmakers have seen him in Springfield since last May when he did something similar. He mentioned the joint address to the General Assembly, and that was last year. So a lot of lawmakers in Springfield are kind of thinking, well, I mean, we don't really see you a whole lot. How do we know what you really want when you're not down here advocating for it when we're actually putting the budget together?
So what was on Johnson's wish list as he was meeting with these legislators?
He's not asking for a whole heck of a lot because he knows that there is, and I think part of this is because he knows that it's a really tough budget year in Springfield. So he's asking for things like $12.5 million in new revenue from making changes to the prepaid cell phone tax that currently exists. He wants to keep the 911 surcharge in effect, the $5 a month 911 surcharge. That would keep $27.5 million coming into city coffers. And he's not, and I was kind of surprised when I started hearing about how much he wasn't going to talk about Chicago public schools, because he is asking for help by way of increasing state grant funding, and that would be statewide. And in fact, Pedro Martinez, the CPS CEO, was down in Springfield this week advocating for that same thing.
Yes.
It's all based on evidence-based funding, and it helps I'm trying to explain this as quickly as I can, but basically there was a law that passed that says there was a law that passed that says schools need to have increased funding by this much per year every year until there's funding equity. That's basically it. And there are a lot of people, including Pedro Martinez, who thinks that that number, which is currently $350 million, should be $550 million. And that would help CPS with things like transportation, special education, bilingual education, and that would help CPS. But that's what he's pushing for. He's not pushing for like a pension fix or anything like that.
And so the reception then from state lawmakers was like, where have you been?
It depends. It depends on who you're talking to, because, you know, and the Trib wrote about this too. So there were, you know, he had meetings with people in Springfield, I think over a total of about 2 hours. It was a friendly reception. And there were people in the Capitol that he's friendly with, like Nick Smith. They hugged and, you know, encouraging words were exchanged. But then Senate Republicans held a news conference a couple of hours later saying, why are you, what are you doing? Why are you asking for this? Why are you asking for this? Mm-hmm. They came up with a nickname, Billion Dollar Brandon, because he's asking for $1 billion for the Bears, and he's not doing that. But it really depends on who you're talking to. Yeah. The relationship in Springfield is, I would say, different than other mayors.
How important is it, Carrie, that Chicago gets this funding support from the state?
It's important, and it's extremely important for the mayor to have a good relationship in Springfield, as Alex is saying. You know, Rahm Emanuel, you know, notoriously didn't go down there, but he worked the phones and he worked his connections to get what he needed. Mayor Richard Daley, same way. You know, so it's, and as the federal government continues to make cuts, then, you know, we need the state to step in. Right. I mean, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but there's a lot of people asking for money from the state right now, including the transportation agencies.
If we don't find a way to close this budget gap, what could happen?
I mean, well, it depends which area specifically. I mean, transit, which I've been covering, there could be service cuts and there could be job losses. But, you know, that you could probably apply that to any sector if they lose this, if they don't have the right funding.
Alex, as Carrie alluded to, everybody's got their own problems right now. Everybody needs money. What challenges would you say Springfield has on its own?
Well, there are a lot of problems because they have to figure out how to get equitable funding for everybody. So it's not just Chicago that they're concerned about, but they're also worried about where federal funding is going to come in for programs downstate. And I think a big thing that you're seeing as part of this is, and I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later in the show, but the issues with public transit. Mm-hmm. That is something that is kind of a big albatross over state lawmakers. And it's an example of something that is something that they have to deal with that they haven't had to deal with in recent years. So there's just there, at least for me, there's a lot of uncertainty in Springfield right now because there's a lot of uncertain budget pressures that we just don't really know the full scope of.
But as Alex is mentioning with transit, you know, that's a Chicago region issue. And then you have the whole rest of the state that often this is a perennial issue in Springfield where they say, well, wait, what am I going to get? Look at what the USDA is cutting my funds here in rural areas. Mm-hmm. Why should we be throwing $1.5 billion, you know, over to transit in the Chicago area? And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why they should, but that would be some of the pushback.
Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle was also in Springfield, Alex. Did her list of priorities look any different?
Well, she didn't have a list per se, at least not that she told us about, but she was down there advocating for, guess what? Public transit.
Yeah.
Because this is a big deal in the Chicago area facing a roughly $770 million fiscal cliff. And, you know, she seems to be of the mind, and she told people that she was meeting with, that she's of the mind that there needs to be some sort of centralized governance or like a streamlined form of governance. But, you know, there are a couple of different ideas that are floating around Springfield right now. But she seemed to throw her support behind one of them that would do all of the that would take the service boards and kind of merge them into one entity of the RTA. And it's a whole complicated thing. But that's basically what she's going toward. She's going toward less governance. And that's not necessarily where everybody is right now.
Before we turn to some city council news with Sam here, Carrie, there was also news. Speaking of Preckwinkle, a potential candidate is considering a primary challenge. Fill us in.
Yeah. Downtown Alderman Brendan Riley. He's been a downtown alderman for, I think, almost two decades, if not more. A.D. Quigg, our buddy at the Trib, reported this. And I think sort of initially he kind of teased it and then maybe backtracked a little bit, which is interesting because Tony Preckwinkle did the same thing. So President Preckwinkle had said she was going to retire. And then she's like, actually, I don't think I'm going to retire. So, I mean,
she's got a lot of power, right? She's chairing the Cook County Democratic Party.
She does have a lot of power. She also manages to balance her budget. And Cook County's got a big budget, like third largest in the country or something. So it would be, you know, it would be a big job. But like to your point, she is the head of the Cook County Democratic Party right now. So it'd be a tough race, but I don't know, maybe Alderman Riley is like, look, I'm ready for something new. I'm sick of, he's been a pretty vocal opponent of the current mayor.
What do we know about him? What's his reputation been?
He's a little, he's definitely not as progressive as some of his fellow aldermen in the Progressive Caucus. Obviously, he's very business focused because he does represent the Loop area. And
he's a moderate, would you say?
He's a moderate, yeah. And he also, he with Alderman Brian Hopkins, who has the ward right next to him, kind of in Streeterville here, they've been really vocal, actually, and been about, well, more Hopkins about the curfew issue, because this is, this affects, you know, their wards. This affects residents in their wards if they feel like they're unsafe and there's these quote unquote teen takeovers. It also, he's always very concerned with tourists coming in because that is also part of his ward and making sure people are going to businesses in the Loop.
Yeah. Well, Sam, let's dig into that teen takeover conversation, because it has taken over the entire week. Alders are grappling with how to handle these large gatherings of teens that can sometimes turn unruly, sometimes violent. There's a proposed strategy that's stalled this week. What are the alders pushing for?
Basically, what some aldermen in the city council are pushing for is to give the police department the ability to enforce or impose like a snap curfew whenever police officials at the scene of any event determine that it is too dangerous, too much of a threat to public safety. They can effectively call a snap curfew, mandating that everybody go home, leave the area. Yeah. However, there are concerns about the constitutionality of this. Like, how can city law enforcement apply this to just one area at a time at, you know, one or two people's kind of insistence?
We actually had Mayor Johnson on Reset yesterday talking about this very thing. Let's listen.
There is no evidence that lowering the curfew reduces, you know, teen violence or even these large gatherings, right? So there's been 12 incredibly rigorous studies that have looked into this issue. And again, all of them have come back emphatically that what was proposed initially just doesn't get at solving the problem.
So to your earlier point, Sam, the mayor's been very skeptical of implementing this earlier curfew. He's expressed the same concerns you just mentioned about the constitutionality of further empowering CPD. What else are you hearing from critics of this?
Well, these teen takeovers, the teen trends, as are sometimes called, this is not a new issue that the city has faced. This has been going on for more than a decade, as best I can tell. You know, these events, these gatherings are organized very haphazardly on Instagram, Facebook, various social media. And, you know, it's not a new problem. It's something that, you know, as the mayor said, has been studied over and over again. Mm-hmm. And there's really no concrete solution that's been put forth to kind of help abate this. Because at the same time, you know, residents of the downtown area are, of course, entitled to peace and safety within their neighborhood. But also, these are local kids from Englewood, Auburn, Gresham, Woodlawn, and South Shore who are just jumping on the red line and heading north downtown on a warm Friday night.
So there's been lots of talk about getting them jobs and programs and access to things to keep them busy.
Yeah, and the civil rights issue with it would be civil rights advocates would say, well, look at Lollapalooza, how many young people are walking around and, you know, nobody's busting them because they're, you know, it's a lot of white kids from the suburbs. So, I mean, they're out after 10 p.m. So.
And the other side of that coin, though, unfortunately, is that there aren't shootings at the Bean outside after Lollapalooza.
But there have been, but yes, not after Lollapalooza. You're right. Yes, that's you're totally right, Sam. I mean, it's a tough issue, but it's definitely going to be a civil rights issue.
Yeah. So, Sam, update us on some other news here. This is also involving the police. CPD Superintendent Larry Snelling's calling for the suspension of a couple of officers. This is involving the 2024 shooting of Dexter Reed, isn't it?
Yes. One of the more, I guess, attention-grabbing police shootings in recent years. In March of last year, 26-year-old Dexter Reed was curbed by some tactical officers in the 11th District out on the west side. He fired his gun, wounding an officer in the arm. The four other officers there returned fire. However, there are a lot of questions have been raised in recent months as to the legality and the efficacy of the traffic stop that precipitated the shooting. Mm-hmm. After the shooting itself, a lot of outcry. Superintendent Snelling repeatedly called for patience as the investigation unfolded. Now, just last week, city documents that were released by COPA showed that Superintendent Snelling, in fact, did recommend that several officers involved in the Reed shooting had previously violated CPD's rules related to traffic stops in the weeks and months before the Reed shooting. So now he has suggested, or he has called for four officers involved in the Reed shooting to face suspensions for the activities that led up to the shooting itself. The Reed shooting investigation has not yet been completed, but the officers involved have been recommended for suspension.
Let's turn to Chicago's South Side. Neighbors are asking Alders to block development of a proposed hotel near the Obama Center. Let's hear what activist Dixon Romeo of Southside Together had to say.
When you can fast track a luxury hotel, but everyone around that hotel lives in blight, knowing that that'll raise the price to push them out, you're intentionally trying to gentrify a neighborhood, and that's what's happening here in Chicago.
Give us the details here, Carrie.
Yeah, so this has been, ever since the Obama Center, Obama Presidential Center, they decided to go to Jackson Park, Southside, next to Woodlawn. This has been an issue for residents who fear that they're going to be displaced. And that's a very real, genuine, valid fear when their rents go up and, you know, be it $60 or be it $100, whatever, your rent goes up, that's tough. So, you know, Dixon, he's been on this issue for a long time. He's been a longtime advocate and activist in that area. And he's saying, look, we need some sort of reassurance that these residents are not going to be displaced. And how can you seem to find the land for a luxury hotel part? You know, it's, I think it's three parcels of land, one owned by the investment firm and then a couple more by the city. But the city's probably going to sell those at fair, you know, at market rate to this investor. But how can you find the land and the motivation and the funds to build that, but not more affordable housing, thus forcing these people out of their neighborhood that's been their home for decades. So this is a big issue, and it's been a longstanding issue. And, you know, Obama has spoken about this, but, like, you know, it feels it's going to, as the Obama Center goes up.
I was going to say, as the construction continues and we get closer and closer
Woodlawn
to this.
Woodlawn has really changed in, you know, a lot in recent, you know, years and in the recent decade. And so it's an issue that we worry about with all neighborhoods is, like, who are we displacing as we gentrify those?
We shall see more protests, I predict.
Yes.
Let's head back to Springfield real quick, Alex. Do legislators seem close to reaching a deal on that public transit funding you mentioned earlier?
Right. I would say they're close. Closer than they were earlier this year, but I don't think we're going to see anything imminently. And I'm starting to hear some signs, at least within the last week, that lawmakers are not as focused on this. Focus isn't the right word, but they don't seem to have as much of a sense of urgency as the RTA does, because I'm starting to hear rumbles of this could get pushed to the fall veto session. And of course, if that happens, then the transit agencies are going to be in a bind, they say, because if they don't know what state money they're getting by the time lawmakers adjourn at the end of May, then they're going to have to budget based on what they don't know. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to do that. So they're in Springfield. They're lobbying pretty hard right now. And lawmakers are actually kind of irritated because RTA just started the Safe Transit campaign. And they spent a pretty good deal of money on that. And I do think
everywhere.
And I do think that they spent some money here as well. I've heard the funding credits on WBEZ. So they're everywhere. And lawmakers are kind of like, well, that's not how you do this. Let's work this out. So really there are... From my viewpoint, there are two big points of consternation right now. One is who runs this thing and what does it look like? And two, how do you keep people safe on it?
Yeah.
So there are a couple of different proposals, like I mentioned a little bit earlier. One of them would consolidate all the agencies and implement what's called a transit ambassador program. Mm-hmm. And those are basically people who just go around and make sure that people are following the rules, like smoking, no loud music, and making sure that they have a paid fare. But there's a different proposal that would leave the service boards largely intact. And when I say service boards, I mean the people that oversee MetroPace and CTA. Leave it largely intact with some streamlining and some governance changes, but it would also force the new entity to create a transit authority police.
Yeah.
So an actual police force that would patrol the trains and buses. And they just don't know where to go right now. And I don't know, and based on all of that, we're still not hearing a whole lot about where the funding comes from. We are hearing a little bit about a road usage tax that would help fund that. And that's where if you drive, you pay by the mile you drive instead of paying a gas tax.
Mm-hmm.
That's in discussion. But again, it's a lot to get done in a few weeks. And that's basically where we are right now. We're closer, but not there.
Carrie, how does Illinois compare to other states when it comes to funding their major cities?
Yeah, this is a big, you know, point for RTA and other advocates is that we get far less from the state than, say, in Philadelphia or New York. And to be clear, the RTA is not asking the state to give them all $1.5 billion that they say is needed to make sure they don't have these unprecedented cuts, just to chip in on that. And like Alex said, they took some heat from State Rep Cam Buckner in an op-ed, the Tribune editorial board, about this campaign Save Transit Now that has these commercials everywhere. Billboards, I guess on BEZ as well. And Leanne Redden, who's the head of RTA, told me, well, we can't afford not to make everybody aware because people aren't aware. But here's the thing, right? Most people riding PACE, Metra, CTA, they don't really maybe care what the budget of the agencies are. They care that they're going to have a bus and a train, mm-hmm. that it's, they're going to feel safe and that it's clean. So that's the big issue is how, I mean, yes, of course they care. But, you know, if as soon as that stuff starts to hit riders and commuters, if they are not, you know, there's one fewer train on their line, it's going to matter. And yeah. They're also, RTA has been upfront that they may have to consider rate increases, fare increases, which like DC, they've done this. This is like kind of inflation. Mm-hmm. That's when people also start to pay more attention.
No one's going to like that. No. I want to turn to the race to replace Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, because that's already up and running. Race to replace. That's Reset producer Andrea Guffman right there. He said that he won't run for re-election, as we know. That was just, a couple weeks ago. But we clearly have one candidate who's coming out of the gate strong. What should we know, Alex?
Well, I mean, it feels like we have four candidates already, if we're being honest. But we're still waiting for more official announcements and more, you know, who's going to retire announcements. But right now, the race is Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton.
Yeah.
She announced, I think it was less than a day after Dick Durbin, right. That made his announcement, which we were expecting because she formed that PAC in January to help explore the run, et cetera. But I think what we need to know about Juliana Stratton right now is that even though there may not be a lot of people who know her right now because she doesn't have a whole lot of political background other than being a state representative from Chicago and now being lieutenant governor, but she's got a lot of political weight behind her right now. Mm-hmm. J.B. Pritzker was almost immediate in his endorsement of her. And I believe in Carrie, you may have to correct me if I'm wrong, but Tammy Duckworth also. Yes.
Yeah, Tammy okay. Duckworth has. Yeah, that was a big one, too. Yeah.
So and this is going to be really important for Juliana Stratton as she builds her campaign and starts doing outreaches to have this support. But the question becomes, is that going to help? Or it will help. Obviously, money's going to help in politics. But
right.
What else is that going to stir up? Because I'm also hearing through the grapevine that there are some efforts to dissuade other people from entering the race.
Ooh.
So we're
getting juicy.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember. This was either on a Politico or CapFax today, but
yeah,
there
I think
are
Politico.
I think Shia Kapos was reporting that she has sources who are saying that some people on Governor Pritzker's political organization are trying to convince Lauren Underwood not to enter the race. Mm. This is per Politico, and he's done that before. Like if J.B. Pritzker gets behind a candidate, he's going to make sure that candidate has the has the best chance. So
it's getting spicy.
It is. And then so we've got Lauren Underwood, who potentially could announce. I think she will.
Yeah.
Raja Krishnamoorthy, congressman, could announce. I think he will.
Has a lot of money.
Has a lot of money. So and we're also still waiting to see if Mike Frericks, the state treasurer, is going to jump in. And then if he jumps in, who's going to run for treasurer? And then the dominoes start to fall. And it's going to be a really
Alex
interesting political
season.
Alex
with the Springfield tea.
Yeah.
My goodness. All right. One more news item before we take a pause here. This involves a former state lawmaker, disgraced former House Speaker Mike Madigan. Got good news this week, Sam? Hmm?
Yeah. He gets to hang on to more than $3 million that he would have otherwise been ordered to forfeit to the federal government as part of his conviction from earlier this year. You know, the former House Speaker here in Illinois indicted in 2022. And as part of his conviction from earlier this year, he was ordered to repay $3.1 million to the federal government, basically representing the money that ComEd paid to Madigan allies.
Why did prosecutors drop that demand?
It was not disclosed in court, and the statement from the federal prosecutors basically said that, you know, this does not seem to be something worth pursuing in the future. And I think it's worth pointing out, you know, these are assistant U.S. attorneys. They are not the ones making this decision. Like, there's a new U.S. attorney here in Chicago, and he reports to the deputy attorney general and the attorney general. And he signaled to my colleague, Jason Meisner, at the Tribune earlier this week, that priorities at
the Department of Justice in Washington are changing under this current administration. So I would take that as a sign to think that political corruption cases, at least with respect here in the Northern District of Illinois, there might not be the appetite for that that there was maybe a few years ago. You know, read into that too, the mistrial of Emile Jones just last week.
That's right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All tied together.
Next, we turn to how national politics are impacting us here at home. Three new executive orders signed by the president on Monday could have a big impact on Chicago and Illinois. Sam helped us make sense of one that's targeting sanctuary cities.
These executive orders largely revolve around law enforcement's power to go after undocumented immigrants, to remove them from the country, as the administration has made clear. So, you know, obviously Chicago being a sanctuary city does not cooperate with immigration and customs enforcement, and the federal government has filed several actions targeting the city. Various federal funding streams are now under threat due to the city's, you know, continued lack of cooperation. You know, just earlier this year, the federal government filed a lawsuit in federal court here against the city doing that exact thing, seeking to force the CPD to cooperate with ICE agents. However, still pending, not much news there.
Yeah. But so do we know how Chicago police responded to that one? Nothing.
Nothing yet. You know, the policies have not changed. However, one of the other executive orders revolved around consent decrees. The president ordered Attorney General Pam Bondi to, within 2 months, review all federal consent decrees governing reform efforts involving police departments across the country. However, one caveat to that is that in Chicago's consent decree, it was spurred by a lawsuit filed by the state attorney general here against the city of Chicago. The federal government is not party at all to the consent decree that governs CPD reforms. Mm-hmm. And what's more is the Fraternal Order of Police, the union that represents CPD officers, was rejected in their efforts to intervene in the suit and become party to it as well, which kind of further insulates the consent decree from any potential federal forces that might seek to wrap it up. The attorney general's office told me in a statement just the other day, consent decree here in Chicago is not going anywhere. Mm.
And to be clear, CPD Superintendent Snelling and the mayor have been very, you know, clear about this, that police officers will, if there's a valid warrant, it's not like they are practicing any sort of illegal, you know, if there's a valid warrant to arrest somebody, then they will, right?
If there's a federal warrant presented,
then
there's no issues. But if it's just ICE showing up outside the courthouse.
Different story. Yeah. Carrie, the U.S. Department of Education launched an investigation into CPS, Chicago Public Schools. This is over a program that's aimed at improving educational outcomes for Black students. What's going on?
Yeah, the Black Student Success Plan is something that they are saying is a somehow sort of discriminates against other students. This is a plan, of course, in place to make sure that the education there's a leveling of the playing field in education. You know, CTU President Stacey Davis Gates has said, look, you know, Black and Latino kids who make up the majority of CPS schools, they have been falling behind. Mm-hmm. And she points to the idea that, you know, 50 neighborhood schools, many in Black and brown neighborhoods, were closed more than a decade ago. And that contributed to it. And, you know, there's a good quote in the ABC story from Steve Schwinn. He's a constitutional scholar at UIC. And he says that it seeks to promote academic success for Black students in CPS, not at the exclusion of other students. So that's a really important note. Just because you are putting resources into making sure one group is getting, you know, all this, you know, trying to do all you can to make sure that the data supports that they are, you know, that they're succeeding, it's not at the exclusion of anybody, any other student.
And White House actions are impacting a wide range of students from the youngest to the oldest, Carrie. Illinois Head Start, it joined a lawsuit against Trump. Why are they suing?
Well, they are suing because maybe last month the AP first reported that there was this leaked Health and Human Services budget. And in that leaked document, it said that they were cutting Head Start. Obviously, this is very startling. Head Start serves something like 800,000 students across the country. Mm. For people who don't know, Head Start was started in 1965 as a way to provide affordable child care, nutrition services, health care services for families who couldn't afford it. Child care is very expensive.
You're telling me?
Yeah, the idea is that you know, with what the arguments that they make for Head Start, of course, is that this is an economic benefit for everyone because these mm-hmm. kids can go to school, there's care, their parents can work. It's about progress. It's about, there are data supporting the fact that kids that start in Head Start and get into school earlier, they continue on. So Illinois joined three or four other states, as well as parent advocate groups mm-hmm. in this lawsuit in Washington State to say you cannot cut Head Start funding. So
it's critical that Head Start has funding.
Yeah, it's critical. Absolutely. It's a critical program.
Alex, the University of Illinois joined a Big Ten joint legal defense pact against, you guessed it, President Trump.
Yeah.
What's that about?
This is basically the Big Ten schools saying, we see what's happening across the country, and if we're targeted, we would like to pool resources in case one of us is targeted so we all can help.
Everyone's like in early defense mode here against the Trump administration.
I mean, it's one of those things that's taking a while to materialize. Everything that's coming out of Washington seems to be rapid fire. So, yeah, things like this are kind of coming up out of the woodwork, but not every Big Ten school has signed on to it yet. U of I was the most recent one to do it. Their faculty senate voted pretty overwhelmingly to join onto this pact. And what they did was they approved a resolution that encourages President Tim Kaline to, you know, sign this agreement. It doesn't actually have any teeth in it, but it shows a pretty strong force that most of the faculty wants this. So the White House there, and just to kind of recap why this is all happening, the White House is targeting policies on campus that he says are woke, that he says are, you know, promoting anti-Semitism.
Anything that has the word diversity in it.
That's true. And what this has kind of what's kind of happened because of this is, like, it also allows the president to basically revoke the status of students who are doing illegal things. And that has been, we've seen, it's basically been protesting the war in Gaza. So the Big Ten universities are like, well, let's just get together now and let's see if we can work together before this happens. Northwestern, though, interestingly enough, has not signed on to this. Mm. And Northwestern, you might remember, had $790 million in federal grants frozen.
Yeah.
Northwestern is very much in the Trump administration's crosshairs.
I was just going to say, and 790 million other problems with Trump right now.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
We're not quite done yet with the lawsuits against the Trump administration. Chicago's joined unions and other cities in a legal challenge over the firing of federal workers, Carrie.
Yes, this is true. This is another lawsuit in which the plaintiffs would say that Congress should hold the purse strings. That's how it works. They are the ones who make budget cuts, not the president by executive order. I think the thing that's kind of maybe difficult for reporters, and I find this in my reporting to write about and to make people understand with these, is that when you talk to legal experts about executive orders, they kind of say, well, it's squishy. Like, this is not really a law, so it's just an executive order. And as you're seeing with these lawsuits, like Alex is saying with U of I, and you said these are these preemptive actions that people are taking in the fear that the rule of law will not be, you know, that the administration will not adhere to the rule of law. So, you know, this is just yet another one the city of Chicago joins. And I don't know if you guys ever look at these lawsuits, but it's just like on the left side and then against the government. It's all these plaintiffs.
Maybe some Sunday afternoon reading.
Yeah. And like, for example, you know, for Chicago, they say, well, if you get rid of the National Weather Service, for example, that is going to cripple our city, who needs to know if there's going to be flooding coming and other natural disasters, FEMA, et cetera. So City of Chicago joined on with that lawsuit as well.
Yeah. All right. Governor Pritzker is calling for mass demonstrations against the White House. He made headlines for his fiery comments at a Democratic fundraising dinner in New Hampshire.
Never before in my life have I called for mass protests, for mobilization, for disruption. But I am now. These Republicans cannot know a moment of peace. They have to understand that we will fight their cruelty with every megaphone and microphone that we have. We must castigate them on the soapbox and then punish them at the ballot box.
Ooh, Alex, Pritzker came under some criticism for some comments.
He did, and it's really interesting that he is, to me, because what he just said, That's not the first time that he's called for that. He worded it a little bit differently, but he had this speech at the Human Rights Campaign dinner in Los Angeles a couple of months ago. He said, never before in my life have I called for mass activism. And he didn't, again, he worded it a little bit differently this time, but mm-hmm. this is the time, because it had more attention, that Republicans latched onto it. And they say that he is calling for violence. And I guess it depends mm-hmm. on which Republicans you're talking to, because yeah. some of them are just taking the line, you know, he should be more focused on Illinois issues. But then you go to the far right of the Republican Party, and they're basically calling him a terrorist. Like, he's basically, in the quote is, he should be focused on, or let's see, no, J.B. Pritzker called on citizens to terrorize and disturb the peace of their neighbors. Ooh. That's what they took away from that. Well. So.
I want to also play a little bit more, because he wasn't done. He was also tough on Democrats.
Now that this culture of timidity is on full display, those same do-nothing Democrats want to blame our losses on our defense of black people, of trans kids, of immigrants, instead of their own lack of guts and gumption.
Yeah, he was fired up in New Hampshire, Alex.
Yeah, and he's always been, I mean, really, he's always been an ally of the LGBTQ community. He says that whenever he gets a chance to. And yeah. it's true. I mean, he's stood up for the LGBTQ community. But I wonder about his messaging in this moment, because he has also said that part of the reason that Democrats lost to Trump was because they focused too much on their defense of trans people and their defense of black people and their defense of, you know, the homeless. And they didn't focus enough on kitchen table issues.
Yeah.
So. You know, I think he's trying to do both, yeah. basically.
Sam, I mean, these are comments that were bolder than we've recently heard. He's, you know, do nothing Dems. What do you make? He didn't name anybody specifically, but
I don't want to be out of line, but is this like a straw man distraction for a guy who clearly wants to be president? I mean, seriously, like, at the same time that his lieutenant governor is running for Senate, where the incumbent senator has already endorsed her. Like, this just feels like a new chapter of mm-hmm. Illinois power politics.
Pritzker president watch.
Forcing its nose. I mean, seriously, I mean, you got to be kind of detached from reality to think otherwise.
It's like Jimmy Kimmel said last night. I don't know if he caught that, but it's like Pritzker's like, well, there are many reasons for me to go to New Hampshire. Like what? Well, you can go skiing. Did you go skiing?
Right.
Well, it's the Granite State. You can go do a lot of. Did you get any rocks?
He goes on The View. You know, yeah, I mean, there are several recent appearances in recent months presidential. Yeah, Pritzker yeah. president watch.
Anyway, well, protests were happening in Millennium and Grant Park yesterday.
We are appalled by Trump's attacks on immigrants, on international students.
I'm here in solidarity with all the other unions because with greater numbers, we have greater power.
I'm here for also show support for my parents because I know that they can do the stuff that I can do. Yeah, they weren't born here. They're still undocumented, and they've been working here their entire lives.
I'm here to support the immigrants. I believe in opportunities in America. That's what it's founded on, and they deserve the opportunity to do that if they came this far. And it'll make America better.
That might have been Union Park. I'll triple check that. But despite the rain, thousands turned out for a May Day rally. So they were voicing opposition to the Trump administration's treatment of immigrants and workers. I mean, did you all know that the first International Workers' Day rally was actually held here?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
I'm giving you Chicago history.
Yeah, totally. Chicago's
1889.
Protests, yes. Our protest history is rich.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Three days later, the historic Haymarket labor riot happened as well. It's not all gloomy. Sam broke down some positive headlines when it comes to Chicago's crime statistics.
Violent crime in the city is down pretty precipitously through the first quarter plus of 2025. Double-digit percentage drops in murders, in robberies, in motor vehicle thefts. And, you know, while this is obviously good news for any and all city residents, this appears to be part of a larger nationwide trend in major cities across the country. You know, we can all recall summer of 2020 in the height of the first COVID summer amid the George Floyd protests and looting and all that came with that. There was more than a year-long period where murders and violent crime in Chicago, car thefts especially, just spiked.
Yeah.
People, you know, honestly freaked out, whoever you talk to.
I got here right in the middle of that.
Understandably so. However, you know, I said through the first quarter plus of this year, violent crime in Chicago is down. You know, it's
we have to say, you know, with the caveat that summer is still coming, mm-hmm. and every year, you know,
there's always that July
and August
spike.
Every year. Unfortunately, that is just kind of the way things operate here in Chicago. But, like, you know, again, for the first 3+ months of 2025, the city is seeing progress. And, you know, earlier this week, Superintendent Larry Snelling pointed to a robbery task force that the CPD had initiated to help curb this, again, surge of robberies and motor vehicle thefts.
So they're saying this contributed, the task force contributed to this decline in violent crime?
There is credit being put there, yes. And beyond that, to CPD's Bureau of Detectives, clearing homicide cases at a far higher rate than in years past. There have been a lot more detectives added to the Bureau in recent years, and the department's kind of tweaked the schedule for when those detectives operate, just in a better effort to kind of bolster the clearance rate. And again, the early returns appear very positive.
Mm. Yeah, and this the trends, it sounds like it's reflecting what we're seeing across the country.
Nationwide, big cities across the country, New York, Philadelphia, New Orleans, you know, again.
Well, I hope it continues.
We all do, absolutely.
We all hope it continues. Let's stick with law enforcement for another moment here. A former January 6th defendant has been found guilty of reckless homicide. Alex, update us on that.
Yeah, I think prosecutors were initially trying to go for first-degree murder, but he got charged with reckless homicide. This was a trial down in Sangamon County in Springfield that John Seidel covered for the Chicago Sun-Times. This happened back in 2022. Lauren Wegner was a woman from Skokie, and she was on I-55 near Springfield when she was heading the correct way, and one Shane Jason Woods was going the wrong way and hit her head on.
Oh, geez.
And what was happening was Woods had been convicted of assaulting a police officer in the January 6th attacks, and he was very depressed about it. So he tried to end his life multiple times, and this was the last time that he tried to do it. And the weird thing about this story is that he got pulled over before that happened. A cop from a small town south of Springfield pulled him over successfully.
Just a routine traffic stop?
Yeah, well, he saw he was going the wrong way, so pulled over. And then after talking to the cop for a couple of minutes, the guy looks at him and says, you know what? I'm going to keep going. I'm going to end my life. Keeps going.
Wow.
And crashes into
Lauren, oncoming traffic.
The way that he described it in court was he was hoping to hit a semi, but Lauren was there instead, and he tried to get out of the way, but they both swerved at the same time. So I'm like, you know what?
What is the culpability of the police in that case?
That first stop.
That's a really good point that has been asked. I don't think that came up in the trial though. That because it's a pretty small town.
And he was doing this for fear of the prison sentence for assaulting people on January 6th.
Right. He had been sentenced, I believe he had been sentenced to 4.5 years for that. And he did not yet go to jail, and this was obviously before President Trump pardoned everybody.
Right.
But now he is facing 4 to 13 years for reckless homicide, and there are other charges like a DUI and a fleeing and eluding and things like that. So sentencing is set for late August.
Mm. Big changes coming for Chicago Public Library cardholders.
Yes.
Including me, Carrie. What are the details?
Okay, this is so funny because we were just talking about, and you said, I guess they're getting rid of the e-card. And I said, I didn't even know you could have an e-card.
Which is all I had.
Which also makes me feel so old because I actually have the card. So I guess that you have to actually get a physical card. And I think this is I think this is the library saying we want to give priority to residents because maybe if you have an e-card, you can check anything out. They also said they're going to put limits on how many e-books you can put on hold. I have like 4,000 e-books on hold right now.
Really?
Yes.
So you're the reason.
Well, I mean,
the rest of us had to suffer.
You have to get on the hold because otherwise, and it moves through.
You're the reason my digital access is now gone.
I am the reason. And so there are fewer items you can put on hold and fewer electronic items you can check out because I think e-books are more expensive than just a print book.
I'm going to go get a physical card this weekend.
Do it.
They cut me off yesterday, so I have to.
Chicagoan. You got to show me that card.
I'm staying, guys. I swear.
You got to get a card.
Pitchfork had its final farewell last summer, but a new music event from a Pitchfork co-founder is coming here in September. What should we know, Carrie?
Yes, this is Mike Reed, whom you're speaking of. And Mike Reed runs Constellation in Roscoe Village, some other. He's a musician. He's done some great arts programming in, over the decades in Chicago. So he's talking about the sound and gravity. It's this multi-day music event. And he kind of told, you know, your colleague at the Sun-Times, like, yes, Pitchfork, great time. Yeah. I feel like I, you know, I did something good there, but it's time to move on. Mm-hmm. And so this is something exciting. This will be in the and a multi-venue based concert community experience in September in the Avondale area.
You gonna check it out, Sam and Alex?
Worth a shot. I mean, I went to Pitchfork many times.
Yeah.
That was like summer camp.
I went to the first one.
The very first Pitchfork?
Ooh.
I went last year without knowing it was the last one. Like, Alanis Morissette closed the whole thing out.
Oh,
and,
yes.
Like, what a way to end it.
But, like, I know,
so, like,
good.
I don't know.
That's
like,
good.
Knowing the organizers, like, it gives me a lot of hope. Like, they put together a great time.
What do you think, Alex?
Really old.
Still not convinced?
Well, no, I'm convinced that I just need to spend a lot more time in Chicago this summer because I'm still trying to get over the Riot Fest lineup.
They crafted that
specifically for people like me. Yeah. It's just, like, that is for me.
Weird Al, come on.
Yes. And Blink-182, are you kidding me? Anyway.
Fans of a beloved Wicker Park bookstore got good news, Carrie. Share that real quick.
Yes, Quimby's bookstore, which is iconic. It was opened in the mid-90s when Wicker Park was changing into the sort of burgeoning art scene that before everybody got priced out in the 90s. And so a former owner announced last December that he was going to sell it. He just said he was done. It wasn't like, you know, nobody wanted it to close. So there was a couple new owners from Denver. I spoke to them this week, and they are, one of whom is kind of from the print publishing world, and they stepped up and bought it. So Quimby's, and they said the indie spirit lives on. The independent spirit of Quimby's lives on. So that's great.
That is so encouraging.
Yes.
While I have you in the hot seat real quick, McDonald's in the Loop is getting a lot of attention. This is for a new menu item. You tried it. Give us a taste.
Okay. The West Loop. So this is the international global McDonald's, and they rotate their global menus. So I had, this is a big deal. This is the Michaloo Tiki Burger. And the reason this is a big deal.
From India?
From India. And if you're like me, a vegetarian, any sort of vegetarian option is fantastic.
And rejoicing.
I talked to people at that global McDonald's who were so excited, and they were coming from, like, people were coming from everywhere to get this thing.
Yes.
It's the most popular McDonald's item in India. I would just, quick tip, buy two. Put the patties on top of each other between one bun. You need two. I see you, Dan. You need two of those patties.
Do you know what we got at our Springfield McDonald's?
What?
McCrispy strips.
Yeah. Also big.
What is that?
They're chicken strips. Okay, that's it. Just say that.
I've got a long way to go.
The French fries, the potatoes at the global McDonald's, they're actually from France. They are very good. They're like potato wedges. It's
I will keep that in mind.
Yes.
All right. As we often do at the end of the recap, it is time to take a look at a media story. Yesterday, Donald Trump signed an executive order directing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to eliminate funding for NPR and PBS stations across the country, accusing them of left-wing bias. Now, earlier in the week, he attempted to fire three of the five board members at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. CPB is now suing the Trump administration. And so, like always, we are going to continue to be transparent here, and we're going to keep our listeners updated as the story evolves. We are out of time. Our job is done, gang. That's it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Carrie Shepherd of Axios, Sam Charles of the Chicago Tribune, and WBEZ's Alex Degman.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Micah Yason. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news you need to know in under an hour. So make sure you're subscribed so that you don't miss out. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a good weekend. Thanks for listening.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or, like, I have another question. Or, like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.